Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Glad you could be part of this program and part of our discussion. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. In some cases, frankly, we look at the long-term ramifications of lack of change in our society. And we want to talk about things like that. Today, we're going to talk about a project that I think is both fascinating, rewarding, and I've been delighted to watch it grow for the last couple of years. And that is the Bishop Street Studios. It's a new kind of community collaboration in our community. It's an interesting housing project. For those of you who are very familiar with the area, it is the old Sunny Acres Orphanage turned into a wonderful collection of studio apartments and housing for members of our community that are coming to us with housing needs and also with mental health issues in the community. My guests today are Jill Bolster-White, who's the Executive Director of Transitions Mental Health Association, and Scott Smith, who's the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo. We really want to talk about how those 34 one-person studio apartments are affecting the housing needs of a rather interesting segment of our community that tends to get ignored whenever possible, set aside whenever possible, and pretended like they're not even there, and that is the independent functioning members of our community who have mental health issues that sometimes get in the way in some ways of their life. And as you know, in this county, housing is not inexpensive. So if you happen to fall into that population, you probably find it challenging to find housing under the best of circumstances. Jill, let's start with the origin of this project, if we can.
Sure. Actually, John Ashbaugh deserves credit for coming up with the idea. He is really involved with the Historical Society, just a, kind of a natural historian. But he noted that our kind of supported housing actually works for the zoning and the location of that Sunny Acres Orphanage building. So he mentioned it to me. I was really excited because, as you mentioned, it's a constant search for affordable housing for the clients we serve. They tend to be extremely low income. They're disabled by their mental illness. And so for me, it was the perfect marriage of a great restoration project, a building that for 40 years had been left abandoned. And I think you probably know it was in pretty awful condition. So, and interestingly, historic, the only building of its kind in the county. So that's how the idea came to be. And then when we really looked at how we would convert it to housing, we turned to the Housing Authority to see their expertise, of course, is in building housing, financing housing. And so that's when the project really became an actual project and not just an idea.
Good. I need to back up slightly before we get into that, Scott, because it occurred to me I forgot to tell people that they can call in and be part of this discussion. I actually get excited about the topic we're going to talk about, forget to give out the phone number, so I apologize. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. You are welcome to be part of this discussion. I do remind you that sometimes when you wait till the last 10 minutes of the program to be part of the discussion, we don't have an opportunity to really answer your discussion questions or your perspective on things. So please join the conversation if you'd like. Scott, the Housing Authority has been doing housing for a tremendous length of time. Looking at ways to do housing in a community that even 30 or 40 years ago, this was not the least expensive community to live in from a standpoint of a cost of living versus in income and housing costs. But in the overall scheme of things, I would say that this particular project was probably small on the scale of things that you folks usually take on. So what did you see the involvement to be for you guys?
That's a funny question in a way, because I think there's probably, I've done so many of these development projects, and they're all difficult. But so in terms of I think this was maybe the most difficult project I think that I've ever been involved with, but extremely satisfying. I mean, there's just so many. The financing was one of the most complicated we've ever run into. The actual construction aspects were extremely complicated. The relationships between city, county, and everybody else were very, very complicated to carefully weave them all together.
We have an hour to talk about.
Yeah.
Let's back up a little bit, because I think one of the things that we probably have to address early in this discussion is the fact that there's a significant population that have mental health issues that get aid and get assistance, get counseling and things in the community. But there's probably a perception for a lot of people that those are people who should be put away someplace. Those are people who should live in a group home. Those are people who can't be out on their own. And I think one of the key things I saw, Jill, in the narrative about this project, because I've been watching it for a while, it's a project I'm really been interested in since you guys started talking about it, is that there are people who want this kind of opportunity to live alone, but they also want to have the opportunity to be part of a supporting environment. And I noticed that the criteria for people to reside there was that they had to be involved in some ongoing mental health work for them as individuals. So, I mean, that's a not a dilemma, but it's a challenge, I think, for you folks.
So the population, you're right, it's an interesting blend. The population that we serve is a group of people who have a mental illness, but they are they do need support to maintain housing, to maintain work and education, and that's really the group of people we're looking at. We've had a 40-year relationship with the county mental health or behavioral health department here, and so because this was on county-owned land and that was our long-standing partnership, all the folks had a connection. And so to be eligible for this housing right, you were someone who could use a measure of support. For some people, that's a significant measure. For some people, that's very little. Some people, you know, just use that kind of a setting, that community type setting, as their natural support system. And so that's really what's ideal, is being able to say to somebody, yeah, this is my experience, this is my diagnosis, I take medications, I do, you know, I work part-time. And that comment, just like any support group, whether it's a cancer support group or a caregiver support group, to have a group of people who has the same experience for such a stigmatized disorder is really powerful.
So for clarification for folks, Transitions Mental Health does have some specific within your agency job opportunities for some of your clientele.
That's right. So okay. We run a couple of social enterprises, Growing Grounds Nursery, Growing Grounds Downtown. That's exactly right. And then we've had people who maybe have come to us from our homeless program and now work as a case manager or in some service provision part of the organization. So we're really proud when people are able to make that progress.
I was concerned about what to not have any of our listeners feel like we're being argumentative about this, but I was wondering, having known some of the questions that challenged you, so we have this, or we started out with this, what I would have to classify, you don't need to use this term, an incredibly old beat up eyesore. To some extent, if it wasn't a historical building, someone should have bulldozed the damn thing decades ago. So behind a reasonably nice residential area off of Johnson Avenue and near Bishop Street, you had this awful eyesore. And then when you talked about turning it into very nice housing and working with Scott to do that, the neighbors you'd never heard from came out of the woodwork to tell you about how what an awful idea they thought this was. I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't want you to have to beat up your neighbors, but they did a pretty good job of beating you up coming to the front of this project.
There were definitely some neighbors who were really concerned about what we were doing and how that would change that part of town. So you're right. There are some really great residential neighborhoods, and I think on balance, people don't want to see their neighborhoods changed. Further, when you're talking about a program that involves mental health, then you do add a layer of concern and misconception about mental illness. So that's something that we were somewhat prepared for, but I think that the neighbors had really heightened concerns. I think that you certainly can't call it an eyesore anymore. It looks pretty fantastic up there.
How did the design project go? I mean, I'm thinking about this from Jill's side. I mean, you're dealing mostly with mental health issues, housing, and the ability to find housing and find employment. Scott, you're dealing mostly with housing issues. But this is a project that I don't think, I don't know. I don't think either of you had taken on this kind of project. With or without the community agitation that it brought about for some people. But how did you start looking at how this would work or wouldn't work? Because for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, the finished renderings of what the project is, and if you go by and see it at the open house, which we'll get into in a little while, it's a lot more than the old building, but it's also tied together very well. But I'm wondering, did you look at it and say, okay, how do we start this and how do we make this into it's a different kind of housing, if you will, because you really designed every unit to be occupied by a sole occupant. And that's a little different than how you look at housing a lot of the times. You tend to look at housing for small families, couples, single parents. So when you're looking at this project, how did it fit into your idea of what ideal housing was?
I'll just chime in real quick. Just as a side note, they're all one bedroom and studio apartments that were constructed, but we're seeing as just generally the greatest shortage in the marketplace right now is one bedroom apartments. There's just this huge demand, and then it goes to the two bedroom apartments. But as a side note kind of a thing. But I think, we're talking with Jill. She knows the demographics of their clients. And so I think of the design in terms of, should it be a two-bedroom, a three-bedroom, et cetera, or what those kinds of things. We really relied on Transitions to Mental Health. And then, I have to give some kudos to the architectural team at Tenover Studios, who were just remarkable to work with as well in the design of the whole thing.
So as the process went on, did you have any neighbors and local community members nearby there that kind of kept a pulse on the project and stayed in contact with you and talked about it? Because I would hope to believe that some of those people ended up with a project that was far better than what they thought they were going to get stuck with.
We had neighbors who were supportive from the very beginning. We also had people who were fans of that building. You mentioned sort of it was this old, dilapidated building, which it was. But of course, there was the range of community opinion about, should it be knocked down? Should it be, preserved in some way? What's the best, highest and best use? So I would say there were neighbors who kept in touch. There are a lot of neighbors who are up on that property, walking their dogs and sort of using it, because it's been pretty much open space other than the old Sunny Acres building. And so we've had neighbors who were super supportive, and then we've had neighbors who've come around and become supporters.
As you were saying that, a question occurred to me that had not been in my thought of questions today. And I wanted to preface it with that because it struck me as an obvious question and a question that had not occurred to me. Your population who will be occupying those apartments, to some extent, their ability to be inconspicuous in society will go away. If I were someone with a mental health issue and I wanted to just live in an apartment in Atascadero, over on Capistrano or something like that, if I were living in housing that was just normal housing, Whether or not I had mental health struggles and challenges in my life may never be known to the people around me. And that would make me feel safer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right.
So now you're going to tell me, gee, we're going to put you in a wonderful housing project, going to find you a good opportunity for housing, and we're going to make you one of 34 people, and everybody's going to know that the 34 people who live there all have a mental health issue.
Well, I want to make it, you're right. One of the things I want to clarify, though, is after the community open house on November 16th, that turns into a private housing project that is not accessible to anybody. So people get to maintain their privacy. That's sort of just like we, you know, don't have to have invite people in or have people walking around our backyards or our apartment complexes. It's the one opportunity the community gets to see that old building. And then after that, it is a private, not accessible project.
Okay. That's good to hear. Mm-hmm. And my hunch is there's still, for the people who are living there, a need for some type of reassurance that they have that privacy there. And I don't know. I mean, there's a road up to the property. It's got parking in front of it. Mm-hmm. You want a situation where people can still have visitors, can come to it. I mean, is it, I don't mean this to sound sarcastically, is it a gated community?
No, that's not sarcastic. It's not a gated community. But the only people who'd be accessing the road are people who live there or their visitors. Mm-hmm. So, so that it's really designed, again, it should be for all intents and purposes like any other development project, whether Haslow developed it or a private developer. So I think that's the way. So you're right. It's been a high profile project. But the open house is kind of a one-and-done situation.
Mm-hmm. Scott, has this kind of question come up in other projects you've done? Because you've done a number of projects that are related to low-income and, in some cases, disabled people who might feel somewhat vulnerable if people know that they're all over there.
Yeah. You know, I think our organization as a philosophy has always tried to do not do giant. We'd rather do a lot of projects scattered around in different locations than 100 unit congregate kind of a thing for that very reason. And so that's been sort of the organization's philosophy from the start, that it blends right in with the neighborhood. You'd never know anything else was, you know, different. And then we always try to be the best looking thing on the block, as well as sort of our also philosophy that we have to try harder. Just like any kind of, you know, minority group, so to speak, which we sort of are. You know, we're the outsiders, the ones without, you know, the clients that don't have enough money to pay for housing without help. We are fighting that stigma, we all have jobs. We go to work really hard every day. It's just that job doesn't pay enough to even rent a one-bedroom apartment in the marketplace. So. We do fight that. We do experience it, but then I think it's just education. It's really education, because it's just, you know, it's when people realize that it's, oh, that's that nice lady that checks me out at Food for Less every week in the grocery line. You know, I'm so glad she got a place to live, kind of a thing. So it's just really putting a human face on it, I think, makes all the difference.
So it may be a situation where we need to just let time pass. We need the people who live there to be reassured by the environment that they're in, that they're going to get left alone to get on with their life. The neighbors around them are going to understand that this didn't bring some incredible problem to their neighborhood. I was thinking I think it's one of the housing authorities projects. They're right on the corner, and I can't remember the name. It's not Lizzie Street, but over the next street is over from. Near French Hospital, there's a I want to call the Brown Apartments, because that's what I remember.
Yeah,
I
probably right on Ella. Is it on Ella right by French?
Yeah, right on Ella. Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a project that I think you folks did a number of years ago that was conspicuous as a housing authority project for a long time, and now it just looks like nice apartments, and nobody even realizes it's a housing authority project.
Yeah, if we're talking about the same one, and that's seniors. It's for seniors, and it's craftsman style design. And it's there was a historic house on it originally that we had to preserve. So I had everything becomes historic at some point, right? So, that's right.
I think one thing too. Scott talked about how complicated it is to fund and finance projects like this. And I think that's important as we are reading about housing and how expensive it is, and the governor is trying to put together funding. It is really complicated and really hard to do. So I know there's questions like, why isn't there more affordable housing being built, and why isn't there more? And it's having gone through this for the first time with all of Haslow's experience, it was very eye-opening to me. We will not do a project this big probably ever again. I think I can say that with assurance.
Actually, you said that with a smile on your face still. Your brow was not all furrowed up. It's like,
takes a little while to recover, but you know, 6 months from now, jump into it again.
I'll be knocking on his door.
What other type of housing projects has Transitions taken on?
We have done smaller projects. So we actually have some other historic preservation experience. We do own a couple of other historic properties, and we've worked with Tenover Studios. They actually worked on preserving a historic house in downtown San Luis Obispo and then adding new units, and did that very same nice job. For people who come to the open house, they'll see to not make a sort of Disneyland-ish, you know, faux old-looking architecture, but to really look at it in a complementary style. So all of our projects have been 5 units or 8 units or 6 units. So this is by and large a much bigger project. So we've done some similar things.
Okay, there was a project in your notes that you guys get to me beforehand, which are delightful to have. There was a reference to a project called 70 Now.
Yes.
Okay. Want to tell us a little about that?
Well, Scott, that's, if you were to ask me the genesis of 70 Now, Scott actually deserves credit for basically putting forward 50 Section 8 housing vouchers and sort of putting it out there for the county homeless services organizing group to respond. And so maybe, Scott, do you want to talk about how that started?
Sure. Yeah, well, you know, there's... So the way I like to think about it, it was a little bit of a challenge pledge in a way, because with certain populations, in order to remain housed, they really need support services like we're talking about today, right? So and that's true with much of the homeless population. In so many cases, there's a lot more going on than just the fact it's not just an economic situation, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, we go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting where we talk about this stuff, but we're always talking about the housing side, but there's just not enough money to provide the there's a lack of adequate services, and that's because there's a lack of money to fund those services. So we finally said, look, we'll put up, I guess it was originally 50 enough housing resources through our Section 8 program. We were able to identify and weave our way through the rule book to carve out a certain number of dollars that said, look, we'll pay for the housing costs for these folks because we know at best they're probably going to be on disability level income and they can't afford anything. So we'll pay for the housing part if there's an adequate service plan put in place to support those. So kudos to the Board of Supervisors because they dug deep and they came up with a good chunk of money that said, okay, and they went out for a request for proposals, and I was so excited because Transitions Mental Health jumped in and it was so courageous to say, we'll take this on. And so we've had a partnership through that program, obviously. Well,
yeah. So was that a developed project, or was it working on housing that already existed and fitting it together?
We took the vouchers and then found landlords, cooperative landlords. And so what the design is a housing first model. So the old way of homeless response was to say, okay, please, you know, stop taking drugs or using alcohol if that's what's keeping you homeless, or you need to sort of have these things in place. And the idea is that we're just going to have people housed and then work on the services, whether it's mental health, substance use, getting people income, getting people identification if they don't have ID, which is, of course, going to prevent you from enrolling in school or getting a job or doing anything. So the great thing about the project is it's actually almost entirely eliminated jail days. I think it was a 97% reduction. These are folks who'd been in and out of jail because of some of the behaviors. Also reduced ER visits and the psychiatric health facility hospitalization. So we were excited. And then the Board of Supervisors since expanded it from 50 now to 70 now. So we have 70 folks housed and enrolled.
Okay. So that, oh, I see. So the 70 now was the size of the program.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scattered site, like Jill was saying. So it's not like, well, let's go build something. There's theoretically, every one of those 70 households could be at all different points of the globe. They're not in one building or anything like that.
And we actually did that. We really tried to make it San Miguel, Chandon, Paso Robles, Arroyo Grande. We really tried to spread it out because homelessness is in every community in our county.
Mm-hmm. And that, well, that fits in with something that we had a program on. We talked to the folks from ECHO about dealing with similar issues and focusing primarily on the homeless population that were homeless families, mm-hmm. because the shelter programs generally are dealing with individuals. It's difficult for them to deal with families, school-age kids, and stuff like that. So it's nice to hear that that's all fitting together. If you just happen to be joining the program now, of course, this is Central Coast Voices, and we are talking today about homeless homeless people and people who are having a housing problem who may have mental health issues. But we're talking about a new project that is people have been moving into for a little less than a month now. It's called Bishop Street Studios, and we'll also tell you about, we're going to hold off as long as we can to tell you exactly how you can go visit it one time only in a week or so, and look at how this fits in to find housing for people who need housing, who have mental health issues. And also, I get back to this, and I may harp on it more than other people do, restoring a building that probably should have been bulldozed if somebody couldn't find a good idea to deal with it, and that was the old Sunny Acreage Orphanage. If you don't know where that is, it is the building to the northwest of the County General Hospital building. And for a lot of people, we just used to drive by that and say, what is this and why is it still here? So it's wonderful to see that happening. This is a word that's come up a number of times before, and that is the stigma of mental illness. I think you folks, for a while, there was a big billboard campaign about Stop the Stigma. Mm-hmm. And I think that this, it still has to be hand in hand with what you're doing. And it occurred to me that there may be some of the people who can reside at Bishop's Studios, mm-hmm. that may decide not to stay there for a long time if they can find other housing or as they grow in the community. And I would say that my hunch is this is not just a project that helps the people who live there, but it helps the community better learn how to work with and assimilate a population that has mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And you're right. We have been trying to work to eliminate the stigma of mental illness because we know that stigma prevents people from even getting treatment, acknowledging that that may be present in your family. But I do think helping people get on track and being able to describe stories of success to say, you know, here's somebody who had this diagnosis, who really struggled, but then now is, you know, working and sort of living their best life. And so that's, of course, what we all want for ourselves and our families. Probably the most frequent calls I get are from parents who have young adult children who've been recently diagnosed with mental illness. And so I think the big questions they have is what's going to happen? You know, what will become of them? What can they aspire to? And so we just try to say that they can aspire to whatever they did before the mental illness came to bear.
So this is a tough struggle for the community, and it's a tough struggle for the people that you're working with on a regular basis. Have you found people who have been resistant to even talk to you about what's going on with them? So I don't want to say people who are in denial of their situation, mm-hmm. but people who keep it so private and so separate that they're not quite sure how to address it.
I actually have family members who do that. So yes, I think that there are people who just don't want to acknowledge it, who kind of want to just try to muscle through. So yeah, that's what we're trying to describe.
Okay. Scott, how does this fit into other projects that you guys are taking on or looking at?
Oh, golly. Well, I know Jill and I are already planning to try to get together for lunch soon to talk about next steps, and maybe we'll try to tone it down a little bit from Bishop Street level of high stakes playing there. But Haslow likes to see our mission as being broad, where we serve general population, workforce housing, to special needs housing as well. And we do a lot of special needs housing. We have quite a few different types of collaborations with Transitions Mental Health, where we have actually opened up some of our larger apartment complexes as group homes for some of the clients to come in, and then Tima manages those. So it fits in perfectly with our mission and what we see ourselves doing in trying to serve a lot of various special needs types of groups.
Yeah. Well, there was some state involvement with this project along with the county. Are other communities looking at the – are they kind of looking at this and testing you out to see what's going on? And are you a guinea pig in any of these projects?
I'm going to let Scott answer that one.
I think that we all try to learn from each other. You know, you read about something in a newsletter and then it's helpful because then you call the person up and say, well, how did you do that? Well, here's the problem we're having. How did you solve it? And so I don't know that we're a guinea pig, but because there's just amazing things being done in lots of different locations throughout the entire country. But certainly I think this was a one of the trailblazing type efforts, and I think there's a lot of things that can be learned from it and shared.
So. Okay. So let's now look at this project and with a couple of curiosities from my standpoint.
Okay.
When did you start letting people apply to be housed there?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the time? Because your quote, grand opening or dedication is in about 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But people have had the opportunity to move in before that. I understand, in my mind when I heard about it, a very wise decision. You don't want to have the grand opening at the very last, just as people are moving in.
Right. So we started working with Haslow to take applications, I think, early this past spring, and we had about 300 people apply for the 33 spots. So one of the spots actually is a resident manager, an employee of mm-hmm. Transitions who will live on site. So there are 33 units. And so that was a whole process to make sure it was very fair. People met all the income qualifications, all those elements. And so it takes quite a long time. It's a pretty arduous and careful process, again, to make sure that it's very, that's a lottery and that it's blind and that people are really selected and vetted and made sure that they meet all those criteria.
So from a standpoint of mental health services, mm-hmm. Were most of these people your clients already, or were some of these people people who you didn't even know about or didn't show up in your system yet but came forward? And so a win-win. Someone who was not getting the services they may have needed in the medical community, who was also getting housing.
That's about a third were people who we had a relationship with, and two-thirds were not. And so some of them might have been actually on Scott's list, on Haslow's waiting list, and just had that perfect, culmination, that nexus of being on Haslow's list, having met all the criteria, and then gotten a spot.
Are there any people because it's designed for sole occupants?
That's right.
Okay.
That's
are there right. people who approached you for the ability to live there with a significant other or a child?
Yes, there were. And it's not designed for families. That's definitely something that we aren't able to do in this project. And as Scott said, because I think both Haslow and Tima identify single occupancy units as our primary need. We do have other congregate housing. We lease, as Scott mentioned, lease some from Haslow. So we have other places that that couples can live, in some cases small families. We don't actually do a lot of family housing as a, as an organization. Haslow does a fair amount of that.
Yeah. So you, the Housing Authority is doing all kinds of housing, obviously. I guess this is a question that came up, and actually I was talking to somebody about the fact we're doing this program, and their thought was, how do you establish what a couple of things, a fair rent for the market, because to some extent you have to make it affordable for people to be able to live here, and that's part of your goal, but you're also competing against people in a lot of cases where we're not looking at a mental health. Not looking at mental health issues, not looking at senior issues, not looking at disabled issues. It's just housing you're helping with. But someone, I'm going to pick badly hypothetical figures. You may establish at the Housing Authority that the ideal rent for this population is $500. And everything around the neighborhood around them is going for $1,000. Do landlords get in a conversation with you and say, you know, you're driving rents down for my prospective tenants, because two people who applied with me last week are now going to move into one of your projects because you're cheaper?
I love it. That's our goal. No, just kidding. No. I know. I mean, that's being completely facetious, but rents are just so incredibly high that I don't think we're having that effect on the market. But how the way the rents work is there's we have to assemble the money that gets used to build these projects from many, many sources. I always say it's like a patchwork quilt, and it's that's a whole other world of how do you get the money to get these things done, especially when it's something the size of Bishop Street Studios. It's not one stop shopping, and so every one of the sources has a rule book. Including here's the maximum rent you can charge for a one bedroom apartment. So, but the way there's a formula for that, it's all based upon the county's median income. And in this case specifically, the state that provided some tax benefits to it, called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, they said that the affordability should average 40% of the county's median income, because that's what they think was going to be the actual demographics of the population.
Even though we look at general housing cost ideally being no more than a third of someone's income.
Yeah. So 40%. So 40%. Let's say so the median income. I got a chart here. Yeah, that's right. 30% of your income is considered what would be affordable for you to pay. Right. So, but 30% of your income, if you're making the average income in the county, that's one number. That might be, you know, $2,000 a month would be your 30%. But if you're only making a minimum wage job, that 30% is going to be, you know, maybe $400 or something like that. So, but long story short, we don't really get to. We don't get the flexibility to say here's what the rent should be, could be. We're given a rule book that says here's the most rent you can charge on that.
This is a flip side of something, as you're saying that a lot of people may not realize. If you are a landlord with just normal income property, when you do your taxes, there's a formula from the federal government that says if you're not charging market rent, in theory, the federal government, if they audit your taxes, can decide that you are sort of sheltering income or somehow not, they didn't get their share. And I was shocked to see that as a factor. But yeah, there's a chart in any of the software for taxes. Well, if you have income property, it will tell you what the median rent is in the market, with a disclaimer that says the IRS expects you to charge rent at which that is the income of the property.
I didn't know that.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Because they want to make sure that you're charging market so that they're able to tax that.
And I was shocked to see that.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's, I wonder if Gavin Newsom knows that.
I think it was a federal issue, not a state issue.
Oh, that makes
from
sense.
That standpoint. So you have, is everybody moved in?
Not yet. Actually, we are just.
Nobody's moving in on the 16th.
No. Everyone should be moved in, and we're hoping everybody takes, the people who live there get to, you know, take the day off and go do something fun while people come and see the project. But no, everyone will be moving in over the next couple of days. So, yeah, so we were just trying to get, of course, the older building was, or the original Sunny Acres building was the most complicated. Had lots of seismic retrofitting. You know, there was just a lot. And then, of course, we had record rains last year. So that made a dent in all construction projects throughout the county.
I remember seeing some early pictures because I have not been in the building. I didn't want to ever go in that building. Anyway, but I remember some pictures that you folks had before the project started as to what the inside of that building looked like. And my only thought was, I'm afraid it's going to fall down while you're trying to restore it. So,
yeah, it was actually in pretty good seismic shape. We were pretty pleasantly surprised, I would say, that that actually worked out, that the brick itself had weathered pretty well. The roof didn't do so well, the windows, you know, some other things. There were fires. I think the weather and teenagers tried their best to do everything they could, but the building survived and it looks pretty beautiful right now.
Mm-hmm. I haven't been by since it's been finished, but I've seen some pictures, and it looks very similar to some, the new part of it looks very similar to some townhouses that are in other parts of town that I have to say are like way too expensive. But anyway, from that standpoint,
I'll say we're going to drive those prices down by the
that's right. Having that's a beautiful townhouse.
Yeah, want to remind you folks, we are talking today with Jill Bolster-White and Scott Smith about an incredible new project, which is called the Bishop Street Suites, and they're actually Bishop Street Studios. Sorry about that. And this is a housing development, really with focus on housing for single occupants who have mental health issues, who are participating in and part of, I think that's a key factor, participating in and part of an ongoing mental health program for their own well-being. And this is a gorgeous housing project that saved an incredibly wretched old building in the process. And they're doing their grand opening on the 16th. If you want to be part of this discussion, we still have some time left. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We've talked about how pleased we are with this project. It's really clear that I've known about this project for some time and have been delighted to see it happen. So have you had any conversations with your grouchy neighbors in the early part of the project that have at least told you, oh, gee, this turned out better than we thought it was going to be, or they've just remained quiet and out of the discussion?
Mostly people have kept pretty quiet, but we have had some people who've been pretty pleased to see the progress who I think were skeptical at first. So I think it is true that some people, you know, just didn't know what to expect. If they don't know the organization, they don't know how those work, they don't know exactly, as Scott said, that you try to be the best looking project in a neighborhood because you want to sort of get out from under the kind of concern. Anyway, so yeah, so I think we've felt pretty good about the way the project's come out.
Okay. Let's see. James in San Luis Obispo, you're on the air.
Hi there. I really appreciate the effort you've done, you've made, and coordinating among your agencies and using the expertise you both bring to this as a project. And I'm just calling to have a little discussion about the resources that you are aware of that might be, I guess, multiplied after this project as an example. For instance, the resource of land, and this was apparently county land, so I'm assuming there was no land cost. There is other land in the city and around the county that is publicly owned, and it seems like now's the time to do kind of an inventory, maybe an accelerated effort to identify properties that are developable as, you know, neighborhood assets and can be, you know, addressed through public ownership and move forward. And also, I think you mentioned that you're working on projects in neighborhoods that are small scale, and I would encourage you to open the doors to homeowner developers to provide some scale of assistance to them to develop one or two apartments in their backyards. There's a lot of R2 kind of zoning where that could be a real plus, and it could build units that may not be affordable entirely to build by a homeowner themselves. Mm-hmm. Does any of that ring like something to do?
I will just say something. Scott's in a much better position. It's true, this was, I think this was unique because it was a county-owned property and the county was excited and motivated about preserving the building. I think Scott's probably a lot more aware about public property that's available around the community. And I think for us, we are looking at, you know, whether we can add a room or a studio or something like that in existing properties. But I'll let Scott.
Yeah, and James, there's you've probably heard of these, what they call ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and just about every city in the county and the county itself has these, what they call accessory dwelling unit ordinances, which is basically if you want to add a little apartment in the back of your house.
Yeah, I guess it's words that you may not choose to use, but we refer to them as granny flats. And
right. I just
wasn't sure if there was a reason why legally that wasn't the term you wanted to use.
No. I think, you know, it's just this new term has sort of come and taken over the granny
flat. More neutral, okay.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's it. Yeah, exactly. But and one of the big deterrents to doing that in the past has there have been a number of deterrents, like you were suggesting. But I know, like in the city of San Luis Obispo, they're trying to really look at removing some of those barriers. So they've done that, for example, with the tiny home concept, made it easier for somebody to put one of those in their yard. They've also looked at their fee structure, because I know fees has been a barrier for a lot of homeowners to do that. And so they've looked at scaling those fees to be, you know, in proportion to what you're really trying to do there to make it more feasible. But then again, every city sets its own rule book, so it's going to be different in Grover Beach than it is here, than it is in Atascadero, et cetera.
Let me point out something. When you talk about ADUs, you're talking primarily about something that's now allowed by right in single-family neighborhoods, R1 zoning. And what I think we're looking at, what I'm talking about is, and that might be a case to address too, but to look at partnering with homeowners, offering a partnership with homeowners to boost their project budget in return for perhaps having a dedicated affordable units so that they recoup their costs. There's a limited profit, but then there's a dedicated level of rental income that they get, and that makes it affordable to people who need affordable units. So it's a team of your agency and maybe mental health as an effort to provide, you know, targeted units for people who have mental disabilities. Yeah. So that's a little different, and I'm just opening up this little box here, hoping it's not a Pandora box, but I think it's a way for the city to address affordability by using public resources, in this case public funding, on a very small scale, because in fact the city doesn't have, in San Luis Obispo, it doesn't have large areas of multifamily zoning to do big projects. So we're really looking at neighborhoods, as you pointed out. Mm-hmm. And I'm just adding that to the mix of the conversation.
I think we'd all be really open to that. It's a creative idea and something that we should probably give some thought to.
Yeah, I think we're seeing some things in other – that's because of the housing shortage and the demand for housing, we're seeing some areas that it's being looked at differently. I mean, there was – the little tiny homes expo, if you will, that was at Madonna Inn a few weeks ago, had a remarkably high turnout of people. Mm-hmm. There was a project on the agenda. I don't know. Actually, I didn't look at the report on it, for a series of small homes that you could purchase on a development in Atascadero, right off mm-hmm. of El Camino, near the Kmart area there. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, I want to say, 30 units on about 2 acres, but those would be actually ownership. But they weren't condos or townhouses. So I think maybe the housing market is bringing some people out. They're looking at some opportunities that they weren't motivated to look at before.
I think that's true.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's true, and I think the market can do some really creative things, but it takes cooperation of cities and counties that set the rule book regarding what you can do in certain zones, what the setbacks are, how many, you know, all those things can be helpful, or they can be barriers to some of these creative ideas.
Yeah. Do people come to the Housing Authority looking at wanting to partner with you? I mean, obviously Jill's happy to partner with you at Transitions Mental Health, but are there other partnerships that people have looked at with you that maybe that you haven't done anything with yet, but that are new opportunities?
Well, we love to partner for lots of different reasons. Usually each of those partners is bringing something to the table, so to speak, that separately you don't have at the time. So we do many properties or many developments in partnership with even for-profit organizations, individuals, and then we do a lot on our own as well. We're doing a joint venture right now in Morro Bay, for example, with a for-profit organization. It's going to be the first affordable housing they've had in many, many, many years. So we do partner. So if anybody out there has a good idea, a lot of times people have great ideas. Mm-hmm. They might even have a little piece of land that they would like to see put to a good community kind of use. So, definitely we are on board with the partnership idea.
And I was going to add, and landlords who have properties who then would be in a position to accept a Section 8 voucher, that's hard to come by. I think some people have concerns about that. Again, preconceived notions about that. And so I think that having landlords who are willing to rent to people who have a Section 8 voucher, that can make a big difference in somebody's life.
Yeah. And well, I'll share with you as a personal experience. It's not a secret. I own a colony house in Atascadero that is income property. We don't reside in it. We looked at whether or not it could be a Section 8 housing because we were willing to do that, and discovered that the retros that needed to be done to a now 104-year-old piece mm-hmm. of property were mm-hmm. almost prohibitive. So I think there, in some cases, the restrictions of Section 8 as far as the structure are very good and very reasonable, but they may make it tough for some landlords to be able to go through what they have to go through to make that work.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
The Section 8 program is a program unto itself, obviously, with lots of rules. But really the housing condition, there is a housing quality standard that has to be met, but it's pretty easy here on the Central Coast, and mostly it's looking at almost exclusively at things that would be considered habitability and safety things. You can't have broken windows. You've got to have a heater. You've got to have operable cooking facilities. Got to have a deadbolt on the front door and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as we end up doing at every program, usually when we're looking at stuff, and that is we get down towards the end. Mm-hmm. I talk too much, and I sometimes don't let my guests talk enough. So my goal is now to basically make sure we have an opportunity for you folks to make sure that everybody who's listening understands what you want them to go away with. So, actually, Scott, I'll start with you.
Oh, goodness. Okay, thanks. What do I want them to go away with?
Jill's been on before. Jill gets the last word.
All right. Okay. I want them to go away with the idea that that the people that need affordable housing are their neighbor, maybe their own kids, maybe their relatives, maybe themselves at some point when they, if they are unfortunate enough to lose their job. It could be their mother, their grand, who's on fixed income, subject to a rapidly rising rent environment. We get a lot of those kinds of calls. So I want you to think about it in a very human way. That housing is about. It's really not about the structure. It's a people issue, and each of those persons that needs the housing. They're all part of our community, and we need to support them.
Okay.
Well done.
Jill.
I, of course, want to invite the entire community to the open house that we're putting on in conjunction with Haslow on November 16th. It's going to be from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and that's a Saturday, so there's a little more parking available. People won't be at work in the county buildings. The Renovate Church on Johnson Avenue is letting people park in their parking lot that day so people can safely use the stoplight on Johnson. But we invite everybody to come and celebrate with us, get to see the community room, walk around the grounds, and just all take a moment to bask in the glow of a really, really cool necessary project in the county of San Luis Obispo.
Okay. And we want to remind folks also that this is their one opportunity to see this project, and then we get to leave the tenants there alone to get on with their lives and appreciate an incredible project. And I would suggest to you, if you look up the hill now, if you drive by and just look up behind General Hospital, you will discover that hill does not look nearly as dilapidated as it did only a couple of years ago. And so it's from that standpoint, it's been a very good project. And I've been delighted to watch this and follow the timeline on about it. Actually, if you're curious about more information, I guess your website, the Transitions Mental Health website, or there's actually a website right now for Bishop Street Studios.
That's right.
That has a timeline of what you went through to get here for
yes.
this. And it's the timeline alone tells us a lot. Anyway, thanks very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for joining us today. This has been Central Coast Voices. I'm glad you've been part of the program with us for a while. We're going to have a really interesting program next week. I'll be with you. Chris Kington had to shift some scheduling around, she and I, so I'll be here next week, and we are going to be talking about a Veterans Day program that is fascinating. Dupreez Brescia, who's a mixed media artist, and others are involved in a thing called Veterans Voices Initiative. We're going to discuss what they're doing, which is art projects and opportunities for veterans to express themselves in a way that allows them to work through a tremendous number of things. It's a fascinating project. Be with us next week, and we'll talk about that. It's really a way to look at how we can support our veterans and make them a more viable part of the community, and in this case, through art. It should be fascinating. Dupreez is a local artist, and we will be glad to talk with her and some other guests that will be joining us then. As I remind people all the time, the Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX Public Radio. You can look at the report of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a snapshot of the community, and that's at actionslo.org. Want to thank Joan Gellert Sargent, who is underwriting this program and has continued to underwrite it for a long time. She's been very helpful in our efforts. You can contact Central Coast Voices at voices@kcbx.org or 805-543-2323. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you to my guests, Scott Smith and Jill Bolster-White. It's been a wonderful time talking with you. Hope you've enjoyed the program. This has been Central Coast Voices.